Good evening and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 22nd in the year 2000. Tonight in our fireside room, we are pleased to have as our presenter, John DeGraff, who will be continuing his series on using television to promote social change. Tonight's presentation is entitled Stewards of Creation. Let's listen in.
Welcome. This evening, I'd like to show you some clips from films about the environment that I've worked on, and I think that illustrate the theme that we really have a responsibility to care for this wonderful world that God has created, and that we certainly see the beauty of in this particular place. I wanted to say that my first dream growing up, what I guess originally thought my calling was as a teenager was to be a naturalist, because I spent a lot of my time, I grew up in San Francisco, and I spent a lot of time as a teenager backpacking in the Sierra Nevada mountains, Yosemite and Kings Canyon. And I see that Mike Williams is here, who was a ranger in the backcountry there, and knows why I like that place so much. And as a young teenager growing up, I had kind of two boyhood heroes, and they weren't probably your normal boyhood heroes, because they were John Muir and David Brower. You probably all heard of John Muir, and probably maybe fewer of you have heard of David Brower. But much of the impetus, I think, for protecting our wonderful natural environment in this country, and especially many of these great and spectacular scenic places that we kind of take for granted, these parks and forests and wilderness areas out here in the West, can be credited to John Muir, who came to the United States as an 11-year-old boy from Scotland in 1849 and grew up on a farm in southern Wisconsin, and eventually actually was raised in a very harsh, stern, pious Presbyterian religious environment by his father, who probably would be akin to some contemporary fundamentalists in his views. And Muir himself ended up rejecting that, but he didn't reject his father's spirituality and his sense of the wonder of the world. And he sought evidence of God's wonder in the beauties of creation around him, and found his temples in especially here in the great mountains of the West. And Muir said, climb the mountains and get their good tidings, and nature's peace will flow into you like sunshine flows into trees. The winds will blow their freshness into you, and the storms their energy, and your cares will fall off like autumn leaves. And Muir felt that he had a responsibility to find a way to protect this wonderful country that he so appreciated, particularly in the Sierra Nevada of California. And he founded the Sierra Club in 1892. And one of the first things that the Sierra Club, one of the first battles that the Sierra Club fought near the end of Muir's life, was the fight to try to keep a dam out of a beautiful valley north of Yosemite Valley that's called Hetch Hetchy. And they lost that particular fight. The dam was built, and Hetch Hetchy Reservoir now provides the water for the city of San Francisco. But Muir was very, very adamantly opposed to the dam. He said, damn Hetch Hetchy, he said, you might as well damn the people's churches, because there's no holier spot than this. When John Muir died in 1914, another fellow, David Brower, was only 2 years old and living in Berkeley, but he grew up to become John Muir's heir and to lead the Sierra Club into many, many struggles for the natural environment. And he became a boyhood hero of mine. I joined the Sierra Club when I was 14 years old, and was then learned a lot about what David Brower was trying to do, to fight for wilderness, to fight against dams, in various places to fight greed and the destruction of the earth. And also, it had no impact on me at the time, but David Brower was a filmmaker. He used his skills actually in making movies to try to convince people that they ought to save these priceless places. And he had a connection to this place, which the film clip that I'm about to show will help illustrate. And in the book, Encounters with the Archdruid, which some of you may have read by John McPhee, it's a look at David Brower, his life and work. And the first story in the book actually begins here in Holden. And he goes with David Brower goes with a geologist whose name is Charles Park. And they hike up into the what is now the Glacier Peak Wilderness, but at that time was still unprotected territory. And Charles Park is determined to create a copper mine about where Cloudy Pass stands, near Cloudy Pass. And David Brower, by the same token, is adamantly opposed to that and wants this entire area to be preserved as wilderness. And he points out the damage done by the Holden mine and to the area and so forth as evidence of why a mine ought not be, an open pit mine ought not be built up near Cloudy Pass. But then he fought, Brower fought for many years to create not only the Glacier Peak Wilderness, but also the North Cascades National Park, which is the area surrounding this, and to protect that area. And it came, it was part of his idea that we really needed, especially in a time in which our society was growing more urban, and that we needed these kinds of places that were protected. So I'm going to show you a clip from the a film that looks at some of David Brower's fight for the wilderness, and particularly the fight to save this area. And you'll see some pictures in it, just a couple, but pictures of what this area and this mine looked like in the late 1950s.
In the morning, he'd know exactly where he was.
I don't know why that happened.
Here we have North Peak, which is not named after all the North.
He's just fun to be with out there.
I'd much rather be out on real mountains than surrounded by mountains of paper.
And the smallest little thing, just to confess me, you think about things newly, the way you would with a small child.
These are known as fairy circles. Long before our human beings began a cut-and-burn philosophy of going through the environment and moving on beyond what they spoiled, grasses were doing it. And the area behind this circle is where the grass has been, and it's fairly much exhausted in nutrients there, so it's moving on for more. To just experience the wildness that the ages have made perfect. It's the thing I like. Everything we have that we use in our everyday life, our vision, our ears, our ability to taste, move, to think, to love, it was all built not in civilization, but all those elements came together in wilderness in a period when there wasn't anything but wilderness on earth.
On September 3rd, 1964, President Johnson signed the National Wilderness Preservation Act, setting aside 9 million acres of pristine country. It was the culmination of a long campaign in which David again played a major role.
Howard Zahnmeister was the leader in that, and I think possibly I was one of his chief assistants. We were talking about our wilderness bill back in the 30s and finally presented the first draft of a wilderness bill in the mid-50s, 9 years later, we got it.
Presently, 90 million acres, most of them in Alaska, are officially classified as wilderness. These are the last sanctuaries where all generations to come can discover the American Earth, essentially as it was before Columbus.
No one should be deprived of what goes on here, a chance to see what makes it work, to see the beauty of it all hours of the day. Well, it's made us. They can't make it. They can only revere it and spare it.
This is Stehekin Landing, gateway to one of the most magnificent wilderness areas in the United States. Here, on a summer weekend in 1988, backpackers come by boat en route to the rugged trails of North Cascades National Park. Dave Brower arrives here too, for a reunion with some of the people who worked hard to create the park 20 years earlier. It was a long effort.
You bring bad weather. I don't know why you have to do this. The last time you came here, it rained all over us.
I like it dry and hot.
Back in 1956, Grant McConnell was a college professor who spent summers in Stehekin. Alarmed by the effects of mining and logging in the area, he took his concerns to David Brower.
It was not a difficult matter to persuade him that this place needed help.
Fresh from his dinosaur triumph, Brower suggested a film to show people what should be preserved. Then he brought his camera and his oldest sons to the North Cascades.
We used to always complain, my brother and I, because we were sort of pressing to serve as models in these movies. We'd have to do this the same routine 3 or 4 times to get it right.
Brower's boys and Grant McConnell's daughter starred as every child who might someday enjoy these mountains.
Up where the trees reach as high as the clouds, where the flower takes the summer wind with beauty, and the summer rain too. They will want to discover it for themselves, the wildness that they ate, that made perfect.
I myself showed that film at least 100 times and always had large audiences that were just enthralled with it. And I was always convinced that they were going right home to write their congressman.
The battle continued into the 60s. Timber and mining companies proved powerful adversaries. As government hearings on the issue approached, Brower looked for yet another way to persuade a reluctant Congress.
He wanted a book desperately, so he called me on the phone one day and said, "Harvey, you're going to write a book. I got to have it in 30 days.
The Wild Cascades was given to every member of Congress to show the congressman exactly what was at stake in North Cascades. And I can't help but think that it had a major impact.
One of the principal signatures of this country.
All right,
yes. And where's your mean typewriter?
After 12 years of effort, Congress created North Cascades National Park.
Without Dave, it wouldn't be a park. He knew the national organization. He knew all. He knew everybody. And if he decided that it was to be done, he knew which buttons to push and how to push them and get things going.
David Brower is still fighting for the environment, and now it goes for him far beyond simple issues like wilderness preservation, and really to look at the whole global picture and our impact on the world environment, on the biodiversity of the world, on the destruction of resources, renewable and non-renewable, and also on our impact on other people. He's 88 years old now, but he's still going strong, at least pretty strong. Well, I'm going to show this particular film Friday evening in full. It's the full story of Dave Brower's life. And at the same time, it's kind of a history of the early American environmental movement and the conservation movement and what it became. Along with John Muir, I would say another major 19th century figure who plays a key role in our interest in protecting the natural world, of course, was Henry David Thoreau, who retreated to Walden to get kind of closer to the earth, who went various places, and actually, differently from Muir, tended to find wonder and beauty in the small things, not the grandeur of Yosemite and so forth, but leaves and grains of sand, you know, what wonder in a grain of sand and so forth. And Thoreau really early on was decrying the whole passion that existed among his contemporaries for going out and using nature in a completely utilitarian fashion, just kind of dig it up, cut it down, and so forth in order to produce the kind of things that we wanted. So at one point Thoreau said that if a man walks in the woods for half a day for the love of them, he's called an idler. But if the same man goes out into those woods and for the whole day and cuts them down and makes earth bald before its time, he is considered an industrious and enterprising citizen. And Thoreau condemned this utilitarian idea that we have. I think there are some real successes to Thoreau, heirs to Thoreau and his ideas in our contemporary culture who write about these kinds of things, who sort of seek out their own Waldens and their own little places that they protect, that they get close to, that they come to understand, and that they find wonder in the small aspects of nature. And one of them, who's a favorite of mine, is a fellow who's both a scientist, he actually teaches environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, but he's also an evangelical theologian. And his name is Cal DeWitt, and I don't know if any of you have heard of him or read any of his materials, but he's an interesting, very interesting combination. And he's, when the fight was on just a few years ago after the Gingrich Congress took over, there was a big attempt to simply gut the Endangered Species Act. A lot of people just really wanted to get rid of it. And particularly, there was a great number of congressmen who had been elected with the support of the religious right and who were oriented in that direction. And after all, in 1980, James Watt, who was at that time the Secretary of the Interior, and I would say a representative of the religious right, and made the statement that we really don't need to conserve any of these kinds of things because after all, the Second Coming is coming and it's coming soon, and therefore that'll all be taken care of. So kind of who cares what happens to the earth? And that philosophy was maybe a little deeper even than James Watt. But what Cal DeWitt did was he went to Congress and he testified as an evangelical, as a theologian, as at least theologically a conservative. And he used the example of Noah's Ark, the story of Noah's Ark in the Bible, as an argument for the absolute duty of Christians to preserve biodiversity, and pointing out that after all, it wasn't said to Noah that he should just get the cattle and the pigs and the animals of use to human beings and put them on the ark, but in fact there should be two of every species, that they were all worthy of protection. And he came with actually several theologians, and they actually had a press conference in Congress in which they brought a cougar along with them, who was on the stage with them and who was actually biting the microphones of the news media that were gathered around. But Cal DeWitt's testimony had some pretty important influence, and a number of these congressmen said that they changed their votes as a result of it, and the Endangered Species Act was not overturned at that time. I want to show you just a little clip about Cal DeWitt in his own setting, the marsh he lives by in Wisconsin, and his sense of wonder at the natural world and the importance of taking care of it. I get the right tape here.
Connection with nature, and so people help each other figure that out as well.
Oh wow, look at this. Here is one of the really rare plants of the wetland. Here is the small water parsnip burial.
It's things like this that really affect me because it instills in you some sense of awe and wonder. And I think the awe and wonder is really the thing that we're missing.
When Cal DeWitt looks for a little excitement, he goes to the marsh instead of a movie or a mall.
This kind of awe and wonder you carry with you.
He can identify more than 80 birds that live in this wetland by their calls alone. He marvels at the flight of sandhill cranes, the texture of grass, and the work of beavers.
From the break of dawn to noon, on through to the setting sun, and then on into the night, there are absolutely dramatic changes. As you stand for a while, things begin to unfold if you're quiet enough to watch and listen. And after a full day, you're not tired either. You tend to be exhilarated from the experience. But perhaps most curiously of all, you come home with your wallet just as full as when you left. And you've got all this pleasure, education, understanding, peace, for not a single penny. One also begins to understand something about how the world works. Perhaps the most dramatic thing you learn is how much human society, our current human society, works at cross purposes with the very principles that we learn here in the wetland. We tend to see the world as a one-way flow, from producer to consumer to trash bin to landfill. Here, everything is recycled. When a stalk of cattails drops down from the marsh, it's just converted again into soil.
For 11,000 years, since the end of the last ice age, Wabeza Marsh has been working like that. All things in the marsh are part of the cycle of life. Nothing is wasted. Cal DeWitt walks through these wetlands with a certain sense of satisfaction. 25 years ago, this marsh was threatened by development. At the time, Cal was chairman of the tiny township of Dunn, Wisconsin.
We declared a moratorium on all land division in our town for 2 years, and we came up with a stewardship plan.
They stopped unplanned urban growth at the edge of Wabeza Marsh and worked together to restore the already damaged wetland to its natural state. Cal DeWitt is something of an anomaly. A scientist and professor of environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin, he is also a theologian and a deeply religious man.
The scriptural teachings really are kind of turned on their head by our modern consumption philosophy. Consume more, then you will be happy. The scriptural view is honor God, take care of creation, deal your bread to the hungry, and then joy comes as a byproduct of service. We try to short-circuit that in our modern society by pursuing first joy, and of course we miss it.
If anyone at any point wants to interrupt with questions or comments or anything, please feel free to do so, otherwise I'll just keep yapping.
Is that one available? What's the name of that whole film, and are you going to show the rest of that one?
No, I'm not showing the whole film. That's from Escape from Affluenza, the sequel to the original Affluenza.
Is that one going to be on public TV also? Or
it has been. Oh. Yeah, it's been on National Public Television twice so far. And again, I wanted to mention to people, because I've had a lot of questions about this, if you want to borrow any of the tapes while I'm here and you want to take the time, there is a VCR in the Creekside room, so when that room's free and available, I think there would, you can just holler to me and I'll give you the tape and you can take a look at any one of these. Some of them we will be showing in the evenings. This evening, the film I'm showing this evening is actually about Native Americans in Washington State, and also has something of an environmental theme. But I want to go to the next one, which is actually more about Native Americans and environment in Washington State, a film that I did called The Moon's Prayer. And I'm going to show just two short clips from that that I think give a sense of earlier traditions, even to our own, and traditions passed down in this region by Native American people about the importance of the environment. So I'm going to show first the very beginning of The Moon's Prayer and the little story that it tells, and then I'm going to show a clip about how many Native Americans in this area feel about the cutting of old growth timber and its impact.
Cedar tree is worth thousands of dollars, so the tree is being cut down. Such trees are now scarce.
We're asked to put together some canoes for the 100-year centennial of the state. We had a difficult time finding cedar trees large enough to make canoes out of. Told one of the timber boys that we couldn't find a tree big enough to sit in.
Today, timber industry practices show greater environmental awareness than those in the past, but some Indian leaders believe more change is needed.
Everything down here is logged. Boulder Creek is 100% lost because they clear cut all above it, get it under the creek up.
Ken Cooper of the Lummi tribe monitors timber harvesting along the forks of the Nooksack River near the Canadian border.
Right now, the media are clear cutting in Rainbow Creek, which is all unstable soil.
Cooper and fellow Lummi activist Jewel James oppose continued clear cutting on hillsides like this one above the Nooksack. They take their concerns on the road, stopping to speak with local residents.
So when we started seeing this happen on this side of the dike, we were very upset about it.
It's pretty hard to do anything to stop it, but it doesn't take a genius to figure out what that's going to do to that river.
James and Cooper have seen salmon streams destroyed when heavy rains cause mudslides on clear-cut slopes. They believe in selective cutting, leaving enough trees standing to hold the soil.
Economically, we all pay when you have clear cuts. And when you have high mountainous areas such as we have here in the Northwest, you have a lot of unstable slopes. And it's just a matter of time and weather those slopes are going to give way.
We've got a mile and a half. This is actual land that used to be up in the mountain. We got 1 mile and a half of land that wasn't here before.
Cooper says sediments, eroding from clear-cut hillsides, are carried by the Nooksack into Bellingham Bay.
When I was a child, we'd drive out here about a half mile down and dig clams. Now there's nothing there but sawdust and silt.
The Nooksack River begins here in Cascade Mountain snowfields.
The mountain range is a place where we'll be fast, or never deep and gray. The rivers and streams all along through this mountain range we use for a spiritual bathing, and each area has a different kind of a gift for traditional people. There's lots of medicine all up that way that the Creator put here.
We still believe it is the Garden of Eden.
There's a lot of people in the cities that will never ever enjoy this forest, but that does not mean that they or their children do not have a right to come here someday and experience some of nature in its finest.
Along the Nooksack, Jewel James and Ken Cooper still follow the spiritual path of their ancestors. Their temples are the old-growth forests, worth more, they say, to the spirit in this artificial age than they will ever be worth as lumber on the market.
Some of these trees are just saplings when Columbus landed here. So these trees are full of knowledge. They've seen lots in their time, and they've got lots to offer poor people like us. When we come and sit beneath these trees, we ask them for some of their power, ask them for some of their knowledge. This is our way of life, understanding. This is where we come and practice and talk. We talk to these trees. You take the drum and you listen to this background noise of the river, you hold it in your hand and start imitating what you're hearing, and you'll pick up a song.
In his spare time, Jewel James fashions art from antlers, gifts from Indian hunters who don't want to waste any part of the animal. His inspiration is the magic of nature.
I cannot force the piece to be something other than it is. I really believe that. I think it's got its own spirituality about it. But it also symbolizes the relationship of humankind's connectedness to the other animals, the other spirits in the world around us.
Any questions or?
What year did you make that one?
1991. Yeah. these films, as you can tell, were made a number of, I've been doing it for about 23 years, and what I'm showing you is kind of a mix of different things, but that particular one was made in 1991. The last clip that I want to show you is a somewhat different story. It's not, I would say, about the environment per se, but it's certainly about creation and about biodiversity. And it's about the biodiversity that we are losing around the world at a rather alarming rate, and that's the biodiversity of seeds, the foodstuffs that we eat. Since the Green Revolution and other industrial agricultural methods, literally thousands and thousands of types of seeds, of plants, have been lost. Plants that could offer us seeds and genetic types of plants that could offer plant breeders terrific opportunities in terms of breeding for resistance to diseases, in terms of breeding plants for things like drought tolerance and salt tolerance and all of the things that we will continually need in a hungry world. And the story that I'm going to show you is a story that takes place way back at the time of World War II and before it. And it's about a group of scientists in Russia who really saw the importance and the value of these seeds and these different types of plants from all over the world and what they would eventually mean to solving the hunger problems that would face the world, and who in the final case, as you will see, made an ultimate sacrifice to save this biodiversity that we now don't think too much about. This is from a film called Genetic Time Bomb. I think it's self-explanatory. There may be a couple of places in here where you might be confused, and I'll be happy to answer those questions.
St. Isaac Square, St. Petersburg, Russia. In this building, the science of crop genetic diversity was born. This is the office where Nikolai Vavilov worked for more than two decades. As director of the prestigious Soviet Institute of Plant Industry, Vavilov believed that diverse collections of seeds were needed to improve crop breeding programs. Beginning in 1916, he gathered seeds and tubers the world over in wild places where few Westerners had ever been before. Harsh deserts, rugged mountains, thick jungles. And his assistants collected nearly 200,000 varieties of crops. At St. Petersburg, then called Leningrad, Vavilov established the world's first seed bank to store and grow out his collections. In 1926, he published his groundbreaking work, Studies on the Origin of Cultivated Plants. Vavilov argued that each of the world's crops, no matter how widely they are now grown, were originally domesticated in eight separate centers of origin. For example, the center of origin for corn was Central America, for wheat, the Middle East, for potatoes, the Andes, and for rice, Southeast Asia. Perhaps more importantly, Vavilov discovered that one was likely to find the most diversity for a crop in its center of origin, since it was there that the crop had evolved longest with climate changes, pests, and disease.
His ideas of centers of diversity and origin pointed the way to future geneticists and plant breeders as to the areas where they should concentrate their efforts in looking for new characters which they didn't have already.
By the mid-30s, Vavilov was widely recognized as the world's greatest geneticist. A steady stream of foreign visitors came to see him in Leningrad.
Oh, he was a larger-than-life character, extremely charming, friendly, treated me, a young graduate student, as though I were an honored colleague of many years' standing, which of course impressed me extremely.
In the eyes of the scientific world, Vavilov stood on a pedestal. But at home, he was in trouble.
He was not against the system, but the system was against him.
In the USSR, the science of genetics was under attack. Trofim Lysenko, a biologist, convinced Stalin that Vavilov's activities were wasted effort, that there were quicker ways to improve Soviet agriculture. Lysenko claimed, for example, that if seeds were soaked in cold water before planting, their offspring could acquire the ability to survive in colder climates.
Lysenko was a charlatan. He stood for fictions. Fictions, but fictions that was beloved by Stalin and his entourage. Because he promised miracles in agriculture.
Vavilov and his assistants defended genetics against Lysenko's bizarre theories, receiving Stalin's wrath in return.
Every day we were coming to work and we just knew that somebody is arrested. Today this professor, next day another one.
In 1940, Vavilov himself was arrested by the secret police and charged with being an enemy of the state. In prison, he was interrogated and tortured.
Night after night after night after night, 1700 hours. And then he was sentenced to death.
In August of 1941, only a year after Vavilov's arrest, the German army attacked Leningrad and blockaded the city. By fall, supplies started running out. By winter, the ration of bread had been cut to 4 ounces a day.
German pilots swooped down and bombed us. There were stashes of sugar, and when they were bombing, everything burned up. The sugar melted into the dirt, and so we ate the dirt.
It was one of the most bitter winters in the city's history, with the temperature falling to 40 degrees below zero. 600,000 citizens of Leningrad died of starvation. At Vavilov's Institute, the scientists worked desperately to protect their seeds.
Many people knew of the Institute and that there was a lot of seed and grain here. The scientists were terribly afraid that starving people might try to break into the building.
Then, as conditions grew steadily worse, Vavilov's colleagues faced the devil's choice: boil and eat the seeds, or starve to death.
You have to imagine the situation. Whoa, Germans. These hungry people, hundreds of thousands, dying in the streets in Leningrad. They themselves, their families, have no food. But they use these seeds. They are priceless.
First, Dr. Dmitry Ivanov, director of the rice collection, died at his desk.
When he died and the people opened his room, they found Dr. Ivanov dead from hunger. All his collection of rice around him in the same room, and even on his table.
One by one, nine scientists, surrounded by tons of edible seeds, perished from hunger, thus saving the seeds that would have saved them. The defense of Leningrad lasted for 900 days, leaving a million dead and the city in ruins. The area around the seed bank, though, was spared from the bombing because Hitler had planned a victory celebration at the adjacent Astoria Hotel. And what finally of Nikolai Vavilov? Though his death sentence was commuted, the man whose discoveries had helped feed millions of people starved to death in prison on
January 26, 1943. So it was a sacrifice because these scientists really knew how valuable this
material that's naturally created to the future of the world. And yet it's really something that we have no thought about. And even today, so much of this material is being lost. And it may be what we need at some point in the future to stop famines and deal with many, many kinds of problems. So those are the clips that I wanted to show you today. They all, I think, have the theme that we are really stewards, that we have an obligation to protect this wonderful world we were given by God, this natural world. That some people have certainly taken that responsibility to heart and worked to do it. And it's something I think we can all at least give some of our time and energy to. Any questions or comments? Yes.
I agree. I also think I'm sure you might agree, it's a really complicated issue. Like, I was wondering if you knew, with the Native Americans, especially in the Northwest, I know sometimes they're in conflict with preservation groups because preservation groups are preserving, like, no hands-on, like, they want a wilderness area. And that might also be the same area where Native Americans fish or do their spiritual practices or use the land. I was wondering if you knew anything about that.
Well, actually, I think those conflicts are pretty rare. I mean, they were probably more in the past, but I think there's been, I think especially maybe because of the work of one woman, who I don't know how many people may have heard of her, but very remarkable woman named Hazel Wolf in Seattle, who actually died this past January at the age of 101. And Hazel is a woman who really became an environmental activist when she was 67 years old, or excuse me, 64 years old, after reading Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1962, and then proceeded to become a tremendous activist in the Audubon Society and to sort of start more Audubon chapters than anybody in the history of the society. But one of the things that Hazel really tried to do was to bring together the groups, even groups that were, including not just the Native Americans and the environmentalists, but also the industry people, the mining people, the forestry people, and get them to talk and sit out together and to begin to work out some of these things. And I think she had a lot of influence. And Hazel, I think, was the first person who really told the environmental groups, at least in the Seattle area in Washington, that they really needed to listen to what the Native Americans had to say and to work out those kind of things. And I think a lot has been done. I mean, the sense I got and have gotten from working with the tribes is that some of those kind of conflicts still come up, but they're not major. There's an awful lot of agreement. Mm-hmm.
There's another historical conservationist to whom I hold in great esteem, and I'm wondering if maybe you have done any work on him, and that was Ansel Adams.
Well, of course, Ansel Adams and David Brower were great friends for many, many years. It was Ansel Adams who actually invited David Brower originally to join the Sierra Club, and Ansel Adams was a great photographer, an active member of the Sierra Club, and a longtime conservationist that did wonderful things. He was probably also the leading figure in the effort to essentially fire Dave Brower when Brower was the executive director of the Sierra Club. This was a very complicated issue. I go into it in the film, and unfortunately, I have met Ansel Adams, but he had already died by the time I was able to do the film. But what it came down to in the late 60s was that Ansel Adams and other members of the Sierra Club board really felt that Dave Brower had become somewhat uncontrollable, especially in the financial end of things. That nobody ever said that Dave Brower was taking money for his own purposes, but he would spend money, they thought, recklessly on his various environmental campaigns. And so there was some real, for a number of years, I think there was some bad feeling between Brower and Ansel Adams, Wallace Stegner, Dick Leonard, the other people in the Sierra Club who had been anti-Brower in this big battle. But they became all very close friends again by the mid-1970s. I think that they realized that the what they wanted to do and the things that they had in common far exceeded the differences that they had. And when Ansel Adams died in 1984, he and Dave Brower were very, very close friends again. And Adams was a strong supporter of what Brower was doing in his new organization, Friends of the Earth.
I guess I'm struck in watching those by the power of these films to speak in just terribly moving ways. And maybe it's because you're a good filmmaker, and maybe it's that plus the content just to speak, but it strikes me that one of the things that none of us are filmmakers other than you, but it strikes me that one of the gifts that the church could offer, the churches could offer, would be somehow using worship or letting worship, allowing worship to speak powerfully about us as part of, you know, not separate from nature, but part of nature, and to care for and tend and live in a sustainable relationship between the human species and the rest of creation. And I guess I'm not trying to propose any answers here. I'm just trying to say that it would be wonderful if people who are moved by this really thought about how worship could be a celebration of Earth and be Earth-centered worship somehow. And I think there are models of that around. I'm certainly a novice in thinking about it, but often we turn to theology to address these things, and it seems like we could turn to worship also, our liturgical settings, our sacramental settings, to help form ourselves into a new kind of concept of who we are, no longer dominators of Earth, but lovers of Earth.
Absolutely.
I mean, I was thinking about, I don't know if Barb was here, but she was talking about the power of music and Revelation to shape communities of resistance to the Roman Empire. And I was thinking about the power of liturgy to shape us as resistors to the domination of exploitation.
Well, I do, I mean, I think the churches are, many of them, trying to speak out about these matters, for instance, the Catholic bishops have made some very strong statements where the environment is concerned, salmon and so forth. And I know that's been true of the other, particularly, I think, mainline churches as well, not so much so from the fundamentalist side. Yes.
First of note, there are some liturgies that have kind of used Earth themes in them, and they're, you know, you just have to start going through all the resources that are available at the different publishing houses, and there are some things there that people have done. But secondly, I love documentaries like these, and Watch Your Work. I stay up far too late into the early morning hours, watch them. They're always on our public stations, you know, 10, 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning.
When they're on and off. Yeah.
When you go to Russia or you interview some of these folks in, mm-hmm. in what was a closed society, do you get the. How eager are they to talk to you about things such as this? And two, what impression do you get of Russian ecology consciousness?
Oh, well, for one thing, I did go to St. Petersburg in 1993, so it was after the change had taken place, and there was certainly a lot of sense of freedom. But I think in St. Petersburg, far earlier than this, Lysenko, who the fellow who was
he's a big figure. In fact, the struggle between Vavilov and Lysenko is a big story in the history of modern science. It's almost like Galileo and the Pope, and it's a real one of those kind of absolute conflicts between two different ways of seeing the world. And of course, Vavilov lost in that Stalin imprisoned him and left him to starve. But in the end, Lysenko, the Russian Academy finally realized that this guy was a charlatan, that this was all fake, it didn't work, and Vavilov was rehabilitated. And in the city of St. Petersburg, everyone knows the story. They all know about the Institute, and they know about these scientists, and it's one place where they really do. And some of the old scientists are still there and have these memories. And I don't have a couple of them in this piece just because what they were saying was too long and it was too difficult to put in this piece. But there were some of the scientists that I talked to, men 90 years old, who would tell this story and absolutely the tears were streaming down as they talked about their, but it was the kind of thing where, you know, media loves to use this sort of thing because it's really emotional and so forth. But it didn't work because it was difficult or I don't remember exactly. It was hard to edit it in. But the feelings are so strong, and people know there what a sacrifice these particular scientists made and how important. I mean, this was really, even though these were not. And again, even though these were not religious people, they were people who I think shared the religious ideal of a calling, that your work meant something and that it was in service to the world and to others, these scientists. And they knew how important these seeds were. And, even though they weren't, even though they weren't religious people, they were willing to give up their lives so that other people would have those things.
Are the seeds still there?
Well, they are, but they're in a pretty terrible condition, and that's one of the reasons why we went there. The institute, it's a little better now than it was. It was really falling into disrepair. One of the positive things about the old system, and there are plenty of negative things, but one of the positive things was that it did give fairly good support to this work, particularly after Vavilov had been rehabilitated and became more of a national hero. And so up until the fall of the Soviet system, this genetics bank was pretty well supported, and then suddenly there was no support for it at all as complete privatization took place. So what's happened, what happened was we got there and the institute was literally falling apart. I mean, things, machines broken, lights broken, mold on the seed, and some seeds that were there but no longer viable for anything. Scientists who were the top people in their fields who were making $30 a month, who could, you know, go out and do some sort of sell cigarettes on the streets in St. Petersburg and make 10 times as much. I mean, literally, that's the sort of kind of economy that globalization has created there. And there were BMWs and a few very rich people, and then many, many people who are suffering terribly from the situation. So what the Institute actually had to do, it owned the buildings, and there were two major buildings that it was in. The bottom floors of those buildings are now expensive boutiques that sell all kinds of knickknacks and trinkets and things for wealthy residents of St. Petersburg. And they still have the two upper floors for the Institute, and the rent that they get from these boutiques is part of what goes to now support this system. There has additionally been money and some support that has come from the West, even some from the U.S. government, but primarily some of the Russian scientists came here supported by folks who care about this issue. There's a group called the Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa that's very concerned about preserving these heirloom seeds. And they brought a couple of the Russian scientists and publicized this case, here in the United States and helped get computers and other support for that institute. So from what I hear, it's better than it was when we went there, but it's still in trouble.
John, can I make a comment, sort of responding what Cynthia was saying, but just thinking out loud, it happens that this year Earth Day, or next year in 2001, Earth Day, April 22nd, falls on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. So it would seem like a logical time for a lot of churches to maybe do something. It's in the Easter season, but I mean, I was just thinking that story of Calvin DeWitt, to show that as a sermon almost. I mean, what a better story of resurrection than a wetland that comes back from nothing to life. And the texts for that day are about Jesus' scars, showing his scars. Well, we can show the scars of the world to, you know, the forest, the clear cuts and stuff. These are scars too. So I don't know. I mean, I suppose the problem would be to get a church sanctuary dark enough to show a film, but I'd love to show that Calvin DeWitt one as a sermon or something, or at least part of one. Have you ever had that? Have you had people use the...
Actually, it has been done like that. That particular show was shown in Cal DeWitt told me about this, that people used it in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is where he's originally from, and showed it there in an evangelical church. I don't know if it's been used other places, but
mm-hmm. are these films purchasable through NPR or other sources?
Well, they're available through various distributors. I think these particular films are available either from a distributor called Bullfrog Films, which is in Pennsylvania, or a distributor called The Video Project, which is in Ben Lomond, California. And I have information on those things, and they do get quite a few churches have purchased the videos. That both of the distributors give special low prices for churches, and they are, I think, quite widely used. Not so much these as the show Affluenza, which I did, which is used a lot more. But I think some of these have been also. Any other?
It would be appropriate just to mention a resource in the Seattle area called Earth Ministry that one could look up in the phone directory, but does profound theological and liturgical work around deep, deep ecological concerns. I'm not involved
Absolutely.
In it, but I know of it. Earth Ministry. There's
yeah.
information resource on that.
Yeah, they're a great organization. I know the folks there. Yeah, they do a lot of great things. Well, thank you all. I appreciate your